So if you were here last weekend, then you might recall that we actually read in the gospel reading what comes after this. They're kind of out of order. It's sort of a weird quirk of the way the lectionary or the readings throughout the church year sometimes don't always correspond with exactly where we are. It just sort of happens. So we're doing the story backwards, and that's fine. And it's actually kind of nice because the last week's message, I just sort of brushed over the fact that the Magi, or the wise men as we sometimes call them, are very mysterious. It's not immediately clear who they are or what they're actually doing. And the reason why that's nice is I had some time off, so I got to waste my time doing all kinds of things. And one of them, I guess this wasn't a waste, taking a little deeper dive into what we might be able to know about who these guys were. Now, there's a little bit of myth-busting that has to happen, and I've said some of this before. There's such a vacuum of information that actually pretty early on in church history, gaps started being filled about who these guys were, and when you repeat things long enough, it just starts to feel like fact. So, for example, the song, "We Three Kings of Orient Are." We don't know if there were three. They weren't kings, and they weren't from the Orient. So, swing and a miss. Actually, three, I guess they're out. That's three strikes. But what can we know? Who were these magi or magoi? We know, at least from Matthew, that they were interested in the stars, so some kind of astrology or astrologers. And that immediately should be weird, because if you take the history of Israel and God's commandments seriously, one of the things that they are vehemently against is astrology. The idea that the stars may be able to dictate the future or tell you about yourself or something like that. For the first century Jewish person, and I would submit for us today, that's utter nonsense. And that runs so deep that that's actually part of why the first story of creation in Genesis is shaped the way it is. The writer's very clear that the things in the sky are just lights. They are created. They are not in any sense divine. So that already should tell us, like, something weird is going on here. And I think part of the reason, actually I think a major reason, why there's a lot of weirdness and there's all these traditions about them having names and histories and all of this stuff, is that the identity of the Magi and where they probably came from was lost to history somewhere about a century after Jesus. See, in that region, which is the eastern edge of the Roman Empire, there was a lot of, I guess, fighting over borders between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire. The Romans had attempted multiple times to basically conquer, like they conquered everything else, the Parthian Empire. But they were horse people. If you're a real big nerd, think The Lord of the Rings, Rohan, the second book. And they were horse masters, and they were very good at that. And as it turns out, their cavalry was absolutely devastating. And it was not until sometime in the first century that Rome was able to gain an advantage over them and defeat them. So there was a lot of skirmishing and fighting going on, and caught right on the edge of that is Judea and Galilee. Through a whole long series of events that I'm not going to get into, Herod the Great was like right in the middle of that. And Herod, being very evil but very smart, was able to use some of that chaos to gain increasing amounts of power. And he was successful at it, to the point where he was originally just a small-time ruler because he was like the son of a friend of Julius Caesar. But eventually he was able to work his way up to the de facto king of the Jews. Now, the Parthians in the east had a certain class of a special kind of priests that were known as the Magi or Magoi. For the time, extremely well learned. One of the things that they were experts on, of course, was astrology, but also astronomy, which, you know, is real, and alchemy, which not so much, and history and religion, and especially like Zoroastrianism and all these other things that you've probably never heard of, and that's fine. The point is, there are echoes actually of the book of Daniel there. And if that doesn't make sense, don't worry about it. But that would be passed, the membership of this very elite group of very learned men from generation to generation. And one of their roles in the world around them was that of being kingmakers. And in fact, a king who attempts to seize power would be very unsuccessful unless they had the blessings of the Magoi or Magi. And so Matthew seems to have tapped into or be aware of that particular tradition. And it makes sense that that tradition would be completely lost, or its context would be lost, because the Parthians were crushed by the Romans about 100-ish years later. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, they were horse people, so our image here, they didn't ride camels. The camels were pack animals. They would have ridden horses. They would have been elegant and very wealthy. The gifts that they brought, there was some mention of those, the two of those items in the book of Isaiah, but I think actually the more likely explanation for why those gifts is really just because they're nice. They're expensive. So as these astrologer, kingmaker types are giving these gifts, in my own historical imagination, I imagine Joseph going, "Oh, sweet, we're selling this and we can finally finish the work on the house. Excellent." Which I get completely now that I'm a homeowner. And so you have this like odd sort of thing happening there, as they find their way first to Jerusalem. Now, there are all kinds of questions about what is this star? Was it a comet? Because apparently some Chinese astronomers noted a supernova in 4 BC. It could have been something, I don't know. I personally think that's irrelevant. If God wanted a bright light in the sky, he could just do that and we would have no evidence of it. That's fine, it doesn't matter. But there were some other things happening there, because in Jerusalem, you notice that when the Magi show up, Herod starts freaking out, and it says all of Jerusalem with him. Why? Why would one man getting anxious freak everybody else out? Well, Herod is at the end of his life by this point, and he knows it. If you really just want to feel grossed out, read about the very end of his life. I'm going to spare you the details, but a lot goes wrong and it's gross. So he's in extremely poor health and he's becoming very erratic, even for him. He's already paranoid. So paranoid that he got his favorite son and his favorite wife killed because he was afraid that they were trying to take power from him. And so as his life came to an end, and as he became more aware of that, even his will and the transfer of power kept changing over and over. And so then you get this entourage, these, I think, Parthian Magoi, these kingmakers showing up to Jerusalem. They're saying, "We saw the rising star. Where's the king of the Jews?" And you have an extremely ill, paranoid psychopath, and I mean that in the clinical sense, who's now going, "How dare somebody take my power?" Of course, Jerusalem's going to freak out. They've been through this before. Herod will kill everybody if he has to. And so then they go through the process of figuring out, we think he was supposed to be born in Bethlehem. It's that way, which leads me to wonder, how'd they figure that out and how did they give directions? They didn't have GPS. I would have probably ended up in Saudi Arabia because I have no sense of direction. But anyway, there are a couple of things that we can just immediately say from that little bit of information. First about Jesus, and then about the whole idea of him being born, is that he's born in a time where there's relative peace in the wider world, but he's born under the umbrella of a lot of turmoil, geopolitical kind of skirmishing and violence, a lot of intrigue and political confusion. Now, we, in our modern era, we have no connection to that. I have no idea what that would feel like. I just don't understand. There's so many. Yeah, if you've read the news, I honestly, even personally, I don't know what opinions to even form. Things just seem to be happening very fast. But in all things, we pray for peace. Now, regardless, it means that Jesus is born into a world that is, in a sense, hostile. And the people to which that world is hostile can shift very rapidly. It's a little more chaotic and uncertain. It's a world that has in it evil people with a lot of power who have no problem using violence to achieve their own personal means. We tend to think of Jesus as though he's just floating around being God all over the place. And that's not really how the stories of his life play out. God's willing to get his hands dirty. God's willing to take risks. That the instant you enter into any kind of relationship with a human being, you are taking some degree of risk. People being, well, people. And apparently God does not feel that he is an exception to that rule. To me, that's meaningful in ways that are sometimes hard to explain. Because everything that we do in our lives carries some element of risk. The instant you choose to love somebody, in any sense of the word love, you're risking a broken heart. You're risking harm to yourself. Sometimes people are dangerous. You're risking the pain of loss. It's tricky. And there's something I think very meaningful about the fact that God has a front row seat to all of that. In fact, he's involved. He's immediately involved. And he understands what that means, what that feels like, what it's like. It's one thing to talk theoretically about things. It's another thing to actually do it. And so Jesus is born already under a cloud of political chaos, maneuvering, and violence, which is the same constellation of things that will come together when he dies. Now, Epiphany, which is the day we observe today, it's actually on the 6th, which is traditionally also when we take down the Christmas tree and things like that. We've already done that. Well, my wife, Katie, already did that. I was just the volunteer muscle to move the heavy stuff. And Epiphany is about Jesus being presented as a light to the Gentiles, to the rest of the world. That not only throughout the biblical narrative do we have this depiction of a God that is very interested and very involved in the goings out, coming in and going out of human beings living very complicated human lives, But it's also an image of a God that is not interested in keeping that contained. Up until this point, for the most part, the story of God has been very ethnic, been associated with one particular clan and his descendants. And they themselves have a very complicated history. And there are hints all over the place that that's not what they are supposed to do. That's a very limited idea. God has much bigger things in mind. And this is perhaps where we get some very large, very profound glimpses of God now taking that next step. Why? Because the wrong people show up when Jesus is born. I don't mean the shepherds. They're fine. They probably smell bad, but they're fine. But these magoi, these astrologer, Parthian kingmakers, whomever they are, they're not supposed to be there. And as Jesus grows up and he starts engaging with the people in a ministry kind of way, bringing the kingdom of God, we start to notice a pattern that the wrong people who show up are exactly the right people. Those are exactly the people that Jesus is coming after. And that's good news, because I'm people too. And so are you. We talked on Christmas Eve about this idea of light. And a couple of y'all came up to me afterward and said, "Oh yeah, I remember somebody saying, I believe in Christianity like I believe in the sun. It's not because I see it, but rather because of it, I can see everything." To which I said, that was C.S. Lewis who said that, and that was running underneath everything that I said, essentially. And we talked about how light isn't, like, the point of light isn't to look at the light. If you look at the light, your eyes might hurt, depending on how bright it is. But rather, light shows you what's in front of you and has been in front of you this whole time. It is Jesus shines his light, he lives his life and engages with the people in ministry, he shows just what it has been, should have been obvious to everybody from the start. Human beings have a tremendous amount of dignity. We are powerful beings, capable of great things. And it's kind of up to us if we decide that those great things are going to be evil or good. We tend to lean towards the evil. If you doubt that, turn on the news, or don't. And so what we have for Epiphany, as these strange visitors from the east, probably Parthia, show up, they're in fact the wrong sorts of people, but they're about to have a little light shining on them in a way I doubt they expected. If they are really kingmakers riding horses, not camels, because they are dignified and they come from the great horse masters and they are known for their cavalry and their chariotry and all of these other things, all kinds of neat stuff that you used to see on the History Channel before it just got weird. But anyway, my guess is that the people that they visit were in, shall we say, slightly nicer accommodations. You were made king in that era. You came from money, big money. You came from power, big political power. You did not come from a family whose father was a day laborer, living in a guest room in a tiny little backwaters town called Bethlehem. No? Nobody? Okay, fine. That really, really was just an inconsequential place as far as global politics is concerned. And so what light does this moment, this epiphany, tell us? Well, I think as human beings, we tend to be drawn towards money and power. We have this natural inclination, especially as modern Western Americans, to equate wealth and power with virtue. Even though the greater wealth and power that you have, the more opportunity to be, shall we say, deeply unvirtuous. And rather than us, like, and whatever we normally would expect in people, or respect in those who are powerful and those that we look up to and so on and so forth, we have just a very humble, normal-looking family in a backwoods town on the eastern edge of the Roman Empire in an area that is really not that important politically, but kind of important geographically. And that's it. Do you think the Magoi were let down? I'm willing to bet that when they showed up, the people who welcomed them brought out the good wine. They probably ate well. They slept in very comfortable beds, or as comfortable as you got back then. You know, Egyptian cotton kinds of things. And instead, they get this little family in a poor village in an area that's not known for being terribly stable. The tricky thing about Jesus shining light is that sometimes he shows us the unexpected. And sometimes it's easy to get lost in that unexpectedness. We look at people of faith who tend to make the news, and they tend to make the news for the wrong reasons. Popular or populist public religion, we usually now, or nowadays anyway, associate with grandstanding and platforms and things like that. But the beauty of the calling of Jesus and the beauty of the Christian way throughout its history has always been that at its core are just average, regular, everyday people doing amazing, great things as they serve the needs of those in their community. They love those who are a little difficult to love. They engage with the people who are sick, who are hungry, who need clothing and other basic necessities. And we have done that throughout our history and changed the world that way. Not through big power or politics or big money or anything else, but rather just living out our vocations. And that's the beauty of the Christian way, that maybe the Magoi, the Magi, were able to get a little glimpse of. That whoever this king child was or is, as they're staring at him saying, this place is awful, this is not the place for a king. Maybe they got a little glimpse of what real power and humility mean. Jesus came to give himself for us, to die in our place, by dying to defeat death itself, to renew our hearts and renew our communities, and then pass himself to us and say, now you go and do the same. And so as we begin this new year, 2026, just still doesn't fit right. My prayer is that this is a year that we renew and remember this idea that our calling as Christians, as followers of Jesus, is to love each other in whatever small ways that we can. To love each other as those who are redeemed by Jesus. And in doing so, in the long run, change the world in a way that the great and powerful simply are unable to do. Amen. As you are able, please rise.